The Guardian.
Once upon a time, there was a very quiet child. He sat through long car journeys without elbowing his sister. He never cried on trains. He even went to bed without complaint. But the parents of this extraordinary child had a secret. They discovered that during the Guardian and Observer book season, you could get 8 children's audiobook CDs for free, including Just William and The Worst Witch. So look out for Paddington, the first in the series, this Sunday in The Observer, and live happily ever after.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
My name is Luke Harding. I was until earlier this year the Moscow correspondent for The Guardian, and I'm sitting in the Pine Bar of the Millennium Hotel in central London, in Mayfair. This bar is famous as the place where, almost 5 years ago, Alexander Litvinenko, the FSB officer turned dissident, was allegedly poisoned with some radioactive tea containing polonium-210. Now, I arrived in Moscow for The Guardian in the beginning of 2007. There was a major international scandal which kind of grew out of what happened in the bar here where I'm sitting. And suddenly it looked like Britain and Russia were once more kind of locked in Cold War battle mode. And I flew in suddenly within about 4 months of my arrival in Moscow. I found myself plunged into this really, really dark, really rather surreal Cold War world where I became the subject of surveillance and intimidation by the FSB, which is the successor agency to the KGB and the same organization which was allegedly involved in Alexander Litvinenko's murder.
Last December, Alexander Litvinenko was laid to rest in London's Highgate Cemetery in a lead-lined coffin. One of the most active Russian dissidents of his generation, Litvinenko was poisoned with a radioactive cup of tea.
When Alexander Litvinenko was laid to rest in London 6 months ago, some thought the secrets behind the former Russian spy's death would be buried with him. Not anymore. British authorities have charged a fellow former KGB agent with murder one.
The evidence sent to us by the police is sufficient to charge Andrei Lugovoy with the murder of Alexander Litvinenko by deliberate poisoning.
Following on from Litvinenko, following on from the Pine Bar, in April 2007, two colleagues in London wrote a story about Boris Berezovsky, who's a big enemy of Putin's living in London, a kind of oligarch figure. I had a very tangential role in all this, but my byline was on the story. And really, from that moment on, the sky fell on my head, and I found myself being followed around Moscow, the streets of Moscow, by strange young men wearing leather jackets. I found myself summoned by the FSB to their investigations bureau into Lefortovo, which is a notorious KGB prison. But also, I found myself the target of repeated break-ins. It became almost a kind of quest for me. Who are these guys who broke into my flat? Why have they done it? What does this say about the Russian state and Russia 2 decades after the end of communism? So after several years of harassment and nastiness and also absurdity, at one point the FSB left a kind of sex manual next to my bed. They disconnected the central heating, all manner of small kind of irritating things basically designed to kind of make me leave the country. But I decided to tough it out, and essentially in November of 2010, I finally turned up for this meeting, and I met two foreign ministry officials who very solemnly began this kind of pantomime of saying I had committed violations. And in fact, these violations were fictitious. But just over 20 minutes into the interview, they made it clear that my accreditation and visa were not being renewed. And I was being expelled, the first Western journalist, actually, to be kicked out of Russia since the Soviet Union.
A more important thing is that you've got a special warning, according to the article 18-2 of the Penal Code of the Russian Federation.
Yeah, okay, fine. Where are we going with this conversation? Let's just keep talking. I don't quite understand.
Второй вопрос.
You can also guess that there were some other violations after the war, after this case in September 2009.
Go on.
Вот у нас пришло
one more letter to inform us about such a violation, and I'll show it here. It's from Nazran, a violation of the administrative rules.
Yeah. Well, I was reporting on the situation in Ingushetia. I wasn't the only journalist to be stopped that day. So I was in Nazran very briefly for a couple of hours.
Это было всего несколько часов.
And then I went back again, and that was
it. Там я вернулся.
Ну понятно. То дело в том, что
the thing is that the situation in North Caucasus changes all the time. It's very difficult to predict what happens there. And we try to warn you to be very careful and very strict. We also insist in your permanent contact and with the local authorities on all your trips and visits there. And in this case, it's another case of a clear violation of the...
But perhaps you could explain how... Okay, how would you do it? Imagine you're me. What do? You phone the FSB, no answer. You talk to the press secretary of the president. He says, come to Nazran, you can meet the president. You go there, and then the local FSB don't like this, and you get a protocol. I mean, what else could I have done?
So, look, that's fairly extraordinary footage we had there. What is that exactly?
Well, when I was summoned to this mysterious meeting in November of 2010 by the Russian Foreign Ministry, I took the precaution of taking my tape recorder with me. These two Foreign Ministry officials said they were kicking me out. The whole thing was just totally crazy. It was ridiculous. They had no reason for doing so, but they were obviously following orders and the best traditions of the KGB.
Of course, you did get kicked out indeed, and you've published a book about your experiences.
Yes, Mafia State it's called.
And the subtitle is How One Reporter Became an Enemy of the Brutal New Russia, which leads me to think that they probably won't be falling over themselves to publicise it in Russia.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the invitation to interview President Putin, as we now have to start calling him again.
We've also got here in the studio Misha Glennie, who is author of a new book on cybercrime. It's called Dark Market, Cyber Thieves, Cyber Cops and You. And it also deals, among many other places, with Russia, because obviously, being such a criminal nation, a mafia state, it's going to have cybercrime as one of its activities, isn't it, Misha?
It is indeed. I mean, it's not just Russia. I have to say, the interesting thing is about cybercrime is cybercrime, the main centres of cybercrime, when they first emerge, were in the BRIC countries, in Goldman Sachs' famous phrase. That is Brazil, Russia, India and China. And for very specific reasons, social situation, the makeup of the society, the high level of education, particularly in Russia, which was a hangover from the Soviet Union. And in Russia, specifically what happened is a deal sort of gelled between the FSB, the KGB, and nascent cyber criminal groups, whereby as long as cyber criminal groups attacked targets outside Russia and the former Soviet Union, and quite specifically in the United States and Western Europe, then they wouldn't pay too much attention to it. But if they were to attack anywhere in Russia itself, then of course they'd be taken away to Siberia before you could say FSB.
One of the things we learned from WikiLeaks is that according to US diplomats, that really government in Russia is this sort of absolutely extraordinary mixture of politicians, bureaucrats, the security services, and the mafia. They've kind of morphed into this sort of single entity. And what we see, not with cybercrime, but similarly, is we see the FSB using gangsters, using mafia bosses to sort of do what the Russian state can't sort of formally or officially do. So I don't know if you remember the curious case of the Arctic Sea ship that was supposedly hijacked and ended up off the coast of Africa. Now, almost everyone believes that this was actually illegal gun running and possibly even delivering very naughty weapons to Syria or Iran from the Russians. But this, according to WikiLeaks, this is one of those classic operations where the sort of spy agency were using mafia guys to do what they weren't really supposed to be doing.
Now, two of the centres that you have in your book, apart from the BRIC countries, are Ukraine and Estonia, which rather surprised me. And you describe Estonia as the most wired country in Europe and one of the leading digital powers in the world.
The president is a very digitalised personality, President Ilves. And one of the things that the Estonian government decided at an early stage was that access to broadband and wireless is a human right and not something that you have to pay through the nose for. So it's actually, when you go to Estonia, it's very, very easy to access the net because you have free hotspots all over the place. This, of course, meant that Estonia developed much more quickly than its neighbors in Latvia and Lithuania. But of course, the more dependent you become on networked technology, the more vulnerable you are to attacks from people who really want to do damage. And this led in 2007 to the extraordinary digital attack, which was called the first cyber war by hundreds of thousands of computers controlled out of Russia on Estonia's infrastructure, and brought it down for about 2 or 3 days, such that they had to close off their internet from the rest of the world.
This book has taken you all around the world, hasn't it? It's taken you to some quite dangerous places.
Well, that was the same with McMaffrey as well. The great thing about cybercrime, if you're investing cybercrime, is that in cybercrime, you have one thing missing that exists in traditional organized crime, and that is the threat of violence. Is that because people can't be violent to you over the net. In fact, one of the great problems that cyber criminals have is dealing with other cyber criminals on the web, because it's axiomatic that they're untrustworthy. And so they've created this very intricate system on the web of trust-building mechanisms between criminals. But, of course, what they tend not to do is beat you around the head with a baseball bat. So, actually, they're a rather different type of criminal on the whole from those who Luke would have encountered in his engagement with the Russian state.
In fact, they got down to some pretty low-down, dirty tricks with you, didn't they?
They would break in. They wouldn't nick anything. So if I'd left money somewhere, they wouldn't steal the money or anything like that. But these break-ins were demonstrative. The whole idea was to show that the FSB had been there. For example, my book begins with the first time this happened, which was in May of 2007, when I came back from a dinner party with my two kids. My wife was away. We were living on the 10th floor of a kind of ugly tower block in northwest Moscow. And we went to my son's bedroom. He was 6 at the time. And discovered the window, which we had double locked because he could have fallen straight out to his death, was wide open. I knew someone had been in, and then at 4:10 a.m. that morning, I heard this mysterious alarm clock going off in the living room, which I hadn't set, but someone had set this alarm clock for sort of 4:10. And this was really my kind of induction into the world of KGB psychology. And I was finally, arrested at Moscow airport in February of this year, 2011, and deported. And 3 weeks later, I went to Berlin. And when I was in Berlin, I met a former Stasi officer who'd been the professor of what the Stasi called operational psychology. And he was basically walking me through the methods that the Stasi used in the 70s and 80s. They did things like they would break into someone's car and then repark it in the same position, but with two wheels on the curb. They would smash a sort of water pipe above a dissident's flat or a target's flat so the water would cascade down. And instead of agitating against the East German regime, they would spend a week mopping it up. Methods designed to basically, the German word is Zersetzung, which means to disintegrate or to corrode, designed to sort of corrode your soul, if you like. And the other reason I think that this book is important is because no one else has written this before, because the FSB is such a kind of chilling organization. We know what they do. That there's a kind of taboo in Moscow. Correspondents don't want to touch this story. And really, after they deported me, you know, part of me just thought, up yours. Time to tell a story.
You just have to be careful about going too often to the Millennium Hotel. Misha, I just want to move to you now. You don't have the personal narrative in your book that Luke has. And what you're dealing with is quite difficult. The material is quite difficult to grasp because it involves a lot of acronyms and it involves virtual reality. How did you shape your narrative for a book?
You have a problem if you're going to write about computers, whichever aspect of computers it is, because computers are, for the great majority of the population, witlessly boring. I focused on this website, Dark Market, It was a website. It was closed down in late 2008, www.darkmarket.com. And it was the premier English language criminal website in the world. And so what I did was to track down the sort of key criminal hackers involved in this website, and I tracked down the key policemen who were involved in trying to bust them, and went and listened to all of their individual stories and wove together the narrative, which was centered on the fact that amongst the five administrators who operated the whole thing and decided whether people were allowed to become members or not, one of them was an agent of the FBI. And so the book is written as a sort of thriller of trying to track down who it was and why and where all these weird people came from. Because the extraordinary thing is they come from all over the world, from different social backgrounds, different ethnic backgrounds. They're all male, which is indicative of something very important. 95% of hackers are male. So they're all really good at maths. They all learnt how to hack at a very young age, 13, 14, 15. And they became involved in crime generally, incrementally, before they'd sort of developed a moral compass. And so by the time they were deeply into criminal activity, they didn't know any other life. This was their life. And it was a life, of course, that was virtual and not real.
Can you just go into some of the examples? I was particularly taken with the first worldwide Carders Conference.
Yes, I wanted to mention that because the press release from the first worldwide Carders Conference, which took place in June 2002 in Odessa in Ukraine, it was fantastic. They invited from all over the world a select group of carders, as they're called, these are people who deal in fraudulent
ATM
credit
cards.
Yes, ATM debit and credit cards. They had working groups on how can we raise the profile of diner cards because not enough people are hacking diners' cards, you know, and they deserve to get more attention. And can we diversify where we cash out with fraudulent credit cards, which means actually taking the money out of ATMs and that sort of thing. So they had this fantastic thing, and they even had a press release from the first worldwide Carders Conference in which they state, and this goes back to Russia, you know, we will not tolerate any assault on the digital and financial infrastructure of Russia and the former Soviet Union. And any carder who does this will be thrown out immediately. And that was the key to the deal. They don't attack their own. And, you know, these are all kids age, most of them between about sort of 18 and 22, but very sophisticated. They understood the politics of the criminal world they were working in, and they made stacks and stacks of money.
And they have wonderful names. The two leading lights in that were called Script and Boa. How Graham Greene is that?
Yes, it's Script, who's a very mysterious character, who it is now strongly believed, and I certainly believe it, that he is a presidential candidate and the leading member of the Internet Party.
I thought he was in jail.
That's Boa.
Oh, it's Boa who's still in jail. They're not quite grown-up boys who are playing this game. Luke, is this something that rings bells with you, this sort of...
sort of thinking, actually, of Julian Assange, who's kind of rattling around my head. Obviously, he is not a cyber criminal. I'd just like to stress that. But
the personality is very similar.
Having co-authored a book on WikiLeaks with David Lee earlier this year, I mean, one of the things we did with Julian was that as well as doing this young portrait of him as a sort of teenage hacker, we dug up these court documents from Australia, which are actually rather pitiful reading, where he was first arraigned for hacking, and his defense lawyer said the computer was his only friend.
They have difficulty interacting in the real world, and they withdraw into the virtual world because it is here that they get the recognition that they crave and they feel they deserve. And often, rightly so, they have fantastic skills on the internet which are not replicated in their real life worlds. And this is why I think that we are dealing with a very different type of personality when it comes to cybercrime than when we are looking at traditional organized crime, and that actually people should engage with hackers rather than throw them in jail for a long period of time, which is what tends to happen now.
I was going to say one point on that, which I think is sort of related, if you like, is also how authoritarian states like Russia, for example, other former Soviet Union states, are actually using the internet. Not as a kind of this great democratic tool, woohoo, let's all have a kind of orange revolution or a green revolution, but actually to suppress dissent and to also to intimidate critics. I mean, if my an extract from my book ran in the Guardian on Saturday, and if you read the comments afterwards, you could see that there were 70% of them were written by kind of Kremlin trolls, people who are paid to shoot down, to try and marginalize, to try and criticize regime critics. And there's this sort of idea that somehow authoritarian states haven't discovered the internet. I mean, we know that's not true. They have. They've wised up. They know who your Facebook friends are. They can play with your email accounts, and they can actually use it as a kind of very advanced tool for picking people off.
They do. And here the Arab Spring was really instructive because Tunisia and Egypt did not fully understand the significance of the internet, and the security services were lax. They would look at individual bloggers and go after them, but they hadn't twigged to the power of social media networking. Whereas in Iran and Syria, both of those regimes were much more advanced in their monitoring of social media networking. And at a very early stage of the Green Revolution, the whole Twitter phenomenon, which supposedly was, you know, a great engine of the Green Revolution in Iran, was actually adopted by the regime itself and used to expose people who were involved in Twitter. And this thing that the Russians and the Chinese do very effectively, which is to mobilize, in China it's called the netizen army, about 200,000 to 300,000 people, some of whom are advanced hackers, is proving a very effective way of using the internet for reasons of suppressing political debate.
So do you think these countries are ever going to give up this? I mean, they're basically tending back towards totalitarianism, aren't they?
Well, it's interesting you say that. This is really, really good moment to talk about Russia, because what happened at the weekend is, as we know, that President Putin essentially announced that having got his little friend Dmitry Medvedev to keep the Kremlin seat warm for him for 4 years, in a sort of basically a piece of legalism, that he was coming back to be president this time for 6 years, because the constitution has changed. So we're looking at President Putin and everything that he represents, which I set out in my book, until 2024. So a longer stint in power than Leonid Brezhnev, and he's kind of closing in on Comrade Stalin if he goes all the way. And I think the most depressing thing about Russia, having just been in Libya, I spent 3 weeks reporting in Libya on the kind of uprising there and the fall of Tripoli, is there will be a Russian revolution at some point, but I see no prospect of that happening soon, because this is a very clever, very cynical, very well-resourced authoritarian state, verging, I mean, it's not totalitarian because they don't lock everybody up, but the point is they don't need to. This is the thing. I mean, if you're a liberal, if you believe in progressive values, if you believe in democracy, how do you change these regimes? I mean, you can't have a NATO bombing campaign all the time. That's probably not advisable either. Engagement doesn't really work.
So we just have to write books about them.
You just have to tell it how it is.
And
put the kettle on.
Well, thank you both very much for coming in. Luke Harding's book, Mafia State, is published by Guardian Books. Misha Glenny's Dark Market is a Bodley Head publication.
Das ist Berlin, Berlin. Die ewig junge Stadt, das ist Berlin, Berlin, die meine Liebe hat, genau im Mittelpunkt der Welt, hat sie der Herrgott hingestellt.
And now, Anna Funder, who also writes about the twilight world of subterfuge and survival in a dictatorial state. Her first book was Stasiland, a non-fiction work about the black farce of life in East Germany, to which we've already alluded. It was shortlisted for the Guardian First Book Award. She's now written a novel, All That I Am. It describes the campaign against Hitler's rise by a group of intelligent dissidents in Germany's Weimar Republic before the Second World War. She talked to Sarah Crown.
At a very basic level, it's about these very early anti-Hitler resistors who were artists and writers and journalists, really, in the Weimar Republic, and then from 1933 when he came to power, at which point they all had to immediately leave the country. And my characters are essentially two couples. And the main action of the book takes place in London between 1933 and 1935, and it's about what it was like to be in exile from Germany, where you would think that you were safe, but actually the conditions of living here were very difficult for those people, and they lived in fear both of being sent back by breaching their visa conditions, which included that they not engage in political activity of any kind.
Incredibly stifling, and that comes across in the atmosphere of the
stifling novel. Thing. And it's about courage and fear and prescience and blindness and resistance and, you know, love and its glories and its failures and all those things. But it's essentially about that particular long before the war period here in London.
And it says on the front of the book, in capital letters, a novel, but that's a very complicated word to use in the context of this book, isn't it?
Not really. I mean, obviously, I've made up the plot, and I've made up all the characters, but I put notes in the end of it because it's important to me that all of these characters had real analogues who really lived. And
why was that important to you?
Because much of it is true, and because the political background is true, and because what actually happened to these women in the flat in Great Ormond Street in Bloomsbury happened, whether or not it happened as I have it, no one will ever know. It was important to me to acknowledge the historical sources in the back of the book.
And one of the sources is this woman, Ruth, with whom you had a friendship until she died in 2001, I think. And she is one of the two narratives of the book. She's telling it retrospectively. She's talking about her story. And I guess, you know, what I was sort of referring to when I said the word novel is complicated is that it is a biography as well. I mean, it is her biography that we're talking about, but you've chosen to sort of express it in this way as a novel. And I wondered why you'd taken that decision, why you hadn't decided to just write it as a straight biography.
Well, Ruth Blatt, who is the inspiration for my character of Ruth Becker, she is the narrator for this book, and the facts of her life kind of bookend this book. You know, the way that she and her husband fled to London and what she did in London. And then at the end, she, in a kind of access of grief, really, she tries to smuggle 150 anti-Hitler leaflets back into Germany in her trousers, really, and is betrayed by another member of the group and ends up spending 5 years in prison under Hitler before the war. So you have a Jewish woman, political activist, in prison between 35 and 39. And that really happened. And then she made her way to Shanghai and she made her way to Australia where I knew her. But the story of Dora Fabian, which is this story that is, in a sense, at the heart of the book because it's narrated by Ruth, my character Ruth. I've made her Dora's cousin and she is remembering this great love of her life, really, and this cousin that she admired. And then the other narrator is Ernst Toller, who is remembering also the great love of his life. And so those narratives offer up then, each in its own partial way, a story that can only ever be partially known.
Mm. And Toller was actually an international figure on the literary scene this time. He was a great playwright whom we've sort of lost sight of in the years since.
Yes, we've absolutely lost sight of him. And his contemporary Brecht was a lot more famous, and because his poetry is better, I think, and his plays are better, and he spent less time as a public figure and political activist and more time writing. But Toller was very famous in his day, and Dora Fabian worked for him. And there was allegedly an unhappy love affair between them. That's all that is known. So that was enough for me. I then went with it.
I suppose it's an interesting book from you, because we know you from your previous book, Stasiland, which again was this very unusual kind of confection of fact and fiction. And this is sort of doing a similar kind of thing, but from, I suppose, from the other side, from the fiction angle.
Well, actually, the difference between fact and fiction for me is really very, very important, and I don't really mix them. I think it's an extremely important contract that a writer enters into with a reader. When you say a book is nonfiction, it really has to be true. And the thing about Stasiland, I think, was that the stories were true, but they were embedded in a present tense narrative with a narrator who was me, and the things that I did were true too, and those observations. And that was a way of mediating something that was in the past and bringing it right into the present, and also of having a narrative that would sustain essentially four disparate narratives within that book. So it's a kind of technical exercise. This one is a novel with intricate relationship with history, but nevertheless, I had a lot more freedom because I could be inside my characters' heads. And I think that, you know, I pushed nonfiction as far as I could push it in some senses, but I wasn't able to be inside my characters' heads in Stasiland, unless they told me they were feeling something, I couldn't describe it. And then if they did tell me, I could only describe it in their own words. Whereas this one is an exercise in representing consciousness from inside someone else's head.
Another thing that this novel is about that we haven't really touched on yet is that it's one of the most affecting portraits that I've read in a long time of old age and the loneliness of old age, because we have Ruth at the end of her life looking back on this incredible, remarkable life that's absolutely stitched into the history of the 20th century. But there isn't really anyone there to acknowledge it and to venerate it, I suppose.
I think that it's easy to forget things. I think that we can be walking along the street and people that we bump into or rub shoulders with can have the most extraordinary stories. And I wanted the sense that history is not far away, that you could pass someone in the street or you could sit in a coffee shop and there'd be an old woman there who was eating, and the whole life that she had led could be this extraordinary story. And I think that there are probably many of them. And I think what it does, or what I wanted it to do, was to make history really cease to be history, to have the 20th century concertina back on itself, so that, as it was with my real friend Ruth, I could be sitting and talking at the table with her about how appalling the tabloid paper is and how horrible commercial television is. And then we would segue, not in a mad way, in a quite sort of, you know, obvious way, and then she would talk about what she had done against Hitler. And then you have this, particularly as a young woman when I first knew her, you have this just collapsing of history. Things that were far away are actually not very far away. And for me, the dynamic of illegitimate government misusing power against citizens who have very little say is something that is eternally repeated everywhere. So, you know, and it's happening now, Libya, China, Burma, all around the place. And I just wanted that to be brought up close. So I wasn't so much mournful about it. I was kind of bringing it into the present.
Towards the end of the book, you have Ruth say, "Imagining the life of another is an act of compassion as holy as any." And I wondered, is that how you felt about it when you were imagining these lives of people who had existed? But as you say, they are an act of your imagination.
I think so. But I think more what I was thinking of was, this book is full of denials of various kinds that I find very interesting. If you're married to someone who you love, you fail to see what is happening in front of your nose in all kinds of ways. As everybody who's had someone cheat on them knows, you just don't want to see it. And marriages survive on denials, big and small. And then there is a kind of political denial. So facts can be known, for instance, in Australia now about refugee boats off our coast, or the St. Louis off the coast of America in All That I Am. Both on a personal level and on a political level, we can know these facts, but whether they're actually taken on in a way that becomes a personal issue or a political issue is quite another thing. Even, you know, lately, last night I was talking about this whole Murdoch scandal, when it was known that, say, hacking is going on. This is something that was known years ago, and it takes a certain kind of narrative about a dead child to arouse the kind of compassion that is necessary to make that into a political issue. And those are storytelling issues.
Tell me about the title, All That I Am.
Well, I wanted a title that was personal. I wanted a title that was very close to the bone of what it is to be human. I think that, for instance, Dora has this sense, or this is what Toller observes of her, of holding her life in her palm to use as she will. You only live once, and that she was going to do these things almost no matter how dangerous. I also more broadly think that we talk about what it is to be human and we say, you know, if you make a mistake, well, we're only human, as if to be human is a flawed and perhaps small thing. And then on the other hand, you say that we think about someone and a whole person is a whole universe unto themselves. They are a miracle. So that is what I was thinking of.
Das ist Berlin, Berlin, die ewig junge Stadt. Das ist Berlin, die Stadt, die meine Liebe hat. Genau im Mittelpunkt der Welt hat sie der Herrgott hingestellt. Du mein Berlin.
Anna Funder there talking to Sarah Crown. All That I Am is published by Viking. Well, I'm afraid it's all been a bit grim this week. So if you're looking for some light relief, why not try our new Dickens London Walk if you happen to be in the capital? You can find it at guardian.co.uk/books. Also there, you can find more of our podcasts and our book clubs. Just click the podcast button at the top of the page and do subscribe to hear our show on a regular basis, either there or on iTunes. So what else have we got to look forward to this week on books? Here to do the honours is Lucy Snow, who's with us on Work Experience. Now, Lucy, you have heard all about what we've got. What has tickled your fancy?
Well, there's a great piece by Craig Brown in the Saturday Review, which is about literary meetings, kind of like a 6 degrees of separation in reverse. It's all quite funny. He shows that Mark Twain is only 3 meetings away from Madonna, and even more bizarrely, that Rasputin is only 3 handshakes away from Paul McCartney, apparently.
I'd like to see how he manages to prove that. Well, we will do on Saturday. Also in Saturday Review, we have a review by Jacqueline Rose of Darien Leader's new book, What is Madness? The Observer will be extracting it, so we'll have all that collected together on the website at the weekend. The book season, meanwhile, continues apace. Our book swap will be concentrating on children's books next week in honour of Children's Book Week. Lucy, tell us what you're going to be up to for that.
I'm going to go to a school called Angley in Cranbrook in Kent to talk to some of the younger students about the book swap. And hopefully they're all going to bring in their own books to swap with their friends. And I think I'm going to bring some books for them as well.
Lovely. And we'll have that up on the Children's Books website next week as well. But that's it for now. Thanks very much to Misha Glennie, Luke Harding, Lucy Snow, and of course to our producer, Tim Mabey. I'm Claire Armistead. Goodbye.
Berlin, du Perle an der dich erkennt. Berlin, der sagt dir nie Adieu, denn deinem Zauber kann man nie was mehr entfliehen. Du mein Berlin, Berlin, Berlin.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.